Hello, my name is Melissa Conley Tyler. I'm the National Executive Director here at the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and it's a real pleasure to be welcoming you here today for our event on Security Cubed: Food Security, Biosecurity and National Security in the Melanesian Arc. Now, this is an event that has been a long time in gestation. We've been very fortunate that Jim Ingram, a fellow of the Australian Institute of International Affairs, and I think one of the most senior Australians ever in the UN system, had showed the vision of wanting to look at these intersecting issues in the Melanesian Arc. His vision was very much to bring together a group of people who perhaps do not already meet as much as they should. It's very easy to be in our silos, to be looking at our particular specialist issues, and what we're hoping for from today's discussion is to bring together huge expertise, but from disparate areas, so that the common knowledge, the common approach can be shared, and we can have a better understanding of some of the issues that we deal with. So it's a real pleasure to welcome Jim. Thank you for doing this. It's been a delight for the Australian Institute of International Affairs to work with the Crawford Fund on this event as a joint event. And so to welcome everybody and to start us off, I'd like to introduce the Honourable John Anderson, former Deputy Prime Minister, and in this context, the newly installed Chair of the Crawford Fund. Thank you, John.
Well, Melissa, thank you very much, and great to be back in harness with you. I'll say just a touch about more about that in a moment. Ladies and gentlemen, terrific to be here, to be enjoying a couple of days in the cool and comfort of the city of 300,000 surrounded by reality that is Canberra, having spent a lot of time here in the past, a couple of days away from the dreadful heat wave of northern New South Wales, where we seem to be tackling or back in the middle of another drought. I see John Lovett there. I was just saying a minute ago that we've just celebrated a great harvest, and I was thinking of him, actually, a tremendous harvest. We're going to have to do something about global warming. We've had 4 years of massive overproduction of wheat around the world, and we're in danger of drowning in the stuff. Meanwhile, it's not worth anything, nonetheless. Great to be with you all, and terrific to be with so many of you of a scientific bent. It's always refreshing, as last night we sat around the table and talked. People who see things clearly, who are able to weigh evidence, who are able to see that in an age when it seems that on every issue there are two sets of facts and you take your choice. The scientist knows that you don't have two sets of facts. You know, but that's the world we now live in. Illogicality, emotion, misguided thinking. You've just referred to it in a way, Melissa. We think in silos. We need to better coordinate and better pursue real objectivity and what have you. Mind you, as we were checking into the motel last night, the director of the Crawford Fund, still current, of course, is Dennis. You would all know Dennis. And there we are at the Hotel Currajong, and the young fellow behind the counter asked whether he was we were together, to which Dennis replied, "No, I'm just the chauffeur." And it reminded me of that yarn about the nuclear physicist in the UK doing an exhaustive trip around the country explaining the latest scientific breakthrough, which was quite technical in nature, but which regardless of great importance in the 1950s. He was complaining to his driver on one occasion. He said, "Here we go, another night out, another talk. I'm getting very tired of it." The driver said, "Oh, sir, I've heard you. I've sat through it so many times that I'll give you a night off. I'll give you a talk. I'll go word for word." And the driver said, "Oh, would you?" The scientist, he said, "That would be just terrific. I'd like a night off." So the driver, you know, gets up, days before newspapers, so nobody recognised the difference, and from mugshots and what have you, gave a talk very eloquently and was immediately stumped by an extraordinarily difficult question. And the professor down in the audience squirmed in his seat thinking, "Oh no, this is going to bring everything undone. How on earth is my driver going to get out of this?" And the driver simply replied, Oh, good grief, he said, that question is so basic that even my driver can answer it. So if you've got any difficult questions today, Dennis will answer it. But I was keen to acknowledge Bob McMullen because we've recently invited him to join the board of Crawford. I don't think he's here yet, but if I could do so, in a spirit of bipartisanship, it would be great to have Bob on board. He's a clear thinker, understands international affairs, former trade minister, and in the spirit of Crawford, you know, where we're really seeking to, if you like, advance the cause of doing the right thing by the needy at the same time as we recognise in a hard-headed way that it's in our own interest to do so, he will help us take it forward. Well, as Melissa has said, the drawing together of people who have experience and skills and a background and are highly qualified in the areas of food insecurity and of biosecurity and of instability and strategic interest for us as Australians is a good thing. And so often we do think, whether it's up there on the hill, whether it's amongst the community itself and its best thinkers, dare I say it, even in academia, we so often tend to silo disciplines which ought to be richly cross-fertilised if we're to extract the best possible outcomes. In that relation, in relation to that sort of approach, in its submission to the Australian government's white paper on foreign policy, the Crawford Fund will argue that global food security is essential for international peace and security, that it serves Australia's national interests, and that a sharper focus on food security, drawing on the unique capabilities of Australian scientists, farmers and food processors, will reinvigorate Australian foreign policy, endowing it with an even more uniquely Australian character. I think it's probably true to say that Australians would be reasonably well aware that our performance in this dry and difficult country to farm in is really quite excellent. And I think it's probably true to say that no country exports a higher production of its food and fibre production than Australia. We only have 24 million people here. We feed and clothe tens of millions of people in other parts of the world. But it's also the case, easily overlooked, that our science and our expertise contribute as much, some might argue even more, to the feeding and the well-being of people in other parts of the world than do our exports. So the draft submission itself draws on extensive literature on the drivers of conflict in North Africa and in the Middle East. Interesting that Syria should turn out to be such an interesting example. That terrible, terrible blight, if you like, on humanity's cruelty to, or reflection on the way we can be so cruel to one another. We watch that dreadful conflict. In many ways, the flocking to cities, the inability of the nation to produce sufficient foodstuffs and so forth, play quite a role, and that's been ignored as we've attempted to understand the cultural and religious and tribal differences that have driven the dreadful turmoil in that area. There's comparable evidence, I'm told, from Somalia and Sudan. Nobody suggests for a moment that it's just food insecurity that causes those problems. It plainly isn't. There are many factors involved, but it can be a very significant driver indeed of instability. And that, in a sense, is something that we ought to be aware of and that I think we could well reflect in our foreign affairs approach more effectively in this country. So here's hoping that the government might take that on board. I'll certainly do everything I can to prosecute the case because I believe in it very strongly. It was interesting that Melissa and I were last together in Yogyakarta, where I had the singular honour of participating in the Indonesia-Australia dialogue talks last year. And Indonesia is a country that is easily misunderstood here in the same way that they, I think, often misunderstand us. It's enormously important to us and likely to be even more important in the future. The simple reality is that it's the fourth most populous nation on earth. It's culturally very different. It is a Muslim country. It's the only Muslim country that I can think of globally where their trajectory of governance, if you like, democratic in a way that is rare in the Islamic world, has been on a good plane in recent years. Although we all watch what is happening in relation to the prosecution of the Chinese Christian running for the mayoral position in Jakarta for supposed blasphemy, with very great concern when you think of Javanese as essentially, if you like, surprisingly peaceful, non-migratory sort of people who love their land, even though it's the most crowded island on earth. This is a very unwelcome development indeed, as I see it. Nonetheless, it, in a sense, underscores the need for us to try even harder, to do everything we can in our powers to make that relationship work. And as I look at what's happening globally and try to comprehend it as I sit on the tractor and listen to the ABC, I'm not sure whether that helps me comprehend it or not, it does seem to me that civilizations rise and fall. The simple reality is that the global architecture, to use a Ruddism, can I put it that way, is changing. We have, regardless of how we felt about it, lived under the mantle of a unipolar order, if you like, the strength and the dominance of Western capitalism led by America, particularly since the fall of the Berlin Wall. We're now facing the emergence, and Jim Ingram, who I meant to acknowledge at the outset, a great hero of Australian foreign affairs and of scientific endeavour, a wonderful man, terrific to see you here, Jim. As you would well understand, this changing world is potentially a very dangerous one. We're seeing the emergence of an old-fashioned multipolar world again. You see the rise again of Russia. Wouldn't have thought that would have happened 15, 20 years ago. You've got India, you've got China, you've got Japan, you've got South America. If they got their act together, probably even Africa. Where in this multipolar world does Australia sit? Of the West, but not in it. In a particularly, isolated part of the world in terms of the West. There we are, cheek by jowl, with Indonesia, a massive country. We're told that it'll be the fourth or fifth largest economy by 2050. And guess what? When we're up there, one of the things that the ambassador was able to tell us, the issue that comes up all the time, the issue that is always raised in terms of the relationship between Australia and Indonesia, wherever he goes in that country, it's not turning boats back. It's not bugging the president's wife. It's not Australians protesting their death sentence. It's the live cattle dispute. It's food security. It's protein. It's food inflation. Those staggering figures that show that even in a country now that has a middle class the size of France or Britain's, as I understand it, the poor in Indonesia are still spending an average of 70% of their income on food. Some of them spend another 10% of their income on tobacco alone, which is extraordinary. But food inflation, and there was a nasty spike in it after the live cattle dispute and the debacle that followed, is an incredibly sensitive issue. It goes right to the heart of everything that we're talking about. So, much to discuss. Melissa's heard this, but I can't help telling you. At that forum, I had the opportunity to tell an absolutely true story, which just reflects it's not just Australians who are able to spin something politically. I was asked to speak to a very large gathering a couple of years ago in Jakarta. And it really was a very big function in terms of numbers, in a very, very smart location. And I walked in to be confronted by the biggest screen, I'm told, in the Southern Hemisphere. It was 40 metres long by 4 metres high. That is a big screen. They'd had it made to order in China. And to my horror, it had a picture of me with dark hair on one side, which produced no end of insults from some of the younger Indonesians. They've got a great sense of humour, the Indonesians. But then over on the other side it had, and remember this is a huge screen, in red and yellow writing, had a small print up the top, we honour our guest, I thought that's nice, my name, John Anderson, in massive writing, it would have been 2 metres high and I don't know how long. And then the two little words, the fine print that can change the meaning of everything? They were there, but they were tiny. The two words, former deputy. And then in massive writing under that, same as my name, Prime Minister of Australia. And I took a photograph of it to bring it back to say to the PM, there's been another palace coup, move aside. The trouble is that by the time we got back, there had been another palace coup. And the new one didn't have as much of a sense of humour as the one before, so I didn't show it to him, or her, I'll let you speculate. I probably shouldn't talk any more about things that many of you know more about than I do. I just want to say I think this is incredibly important. Very keen to hear what is said. If I seem to wander in and out a little bit, that's because Kathy Reid's arranged all sorts of media interviews for me, and I think I have to do one almost immediately. So I apologise for that. But I look forward to, for example, hearing from Bill McGee from Plant Biosecurity CRC, along with other attendees from the Department of Agriculture and Water Resources, whose experience of Australia's biosecurity system and its importance to our agriculture are second to none, to advise the seminar on the threats of invasive species of the non-human kind as we work through the day's proceedings. But again, I just say, pulling together disciplines that are too often siloed can only be incredibly valuable, and I commend those responsible for pulling it together and hope that you will all enjoy the day.
So we'll move into our first session now. I'll just check, am I loud enough if I speak from here? Fantastic, I'll keep it loud. So our first session is looking at the intersection of the three types of security we're spending our day on. We'll be looking at the intersection of food, bio and national security. And our ideal is that we keep these in mind for the whole of the day. Now, as I said, and I should just give all the thank yous and acknowledgements, we very much appreciate Jim's vision in making this happen. We really appreciate working with Crawford on this. And I'd also like to thank the AAA ACT branch members who are here. So to thank to Bob Lowry for coming and for other ACT branch members who are here. The broad structure of the day is we'll start with our introduction to what are our three securities that we have queued for today, and then we're going to have a look at an overview of the Melanesian nations, and we're very lucky to have our senior members of the Diplomatic Corps who are joining us to do that. We'll then, in the afternoon, look at the two domains. We'll be looking at land and sea. And so what you'll see here is that we haven't divided it into what are the three securities. We're quite deliberately in each of the sessions trying to see how do the food security, biosecurity and national security elements play out in each country and then in land and sea. We're pleased to have here today members of the Foreign Policy White Paper Task Force, and so one of the outcomes of today is going to be that your discussions and debates will be recorded, and things that are policy recommendations will be taken forward there, and we very much appreciate the timing that's enabled that possible. We'll also be recording today and putting it onto the AAA's YouTube channel, which will engage a wider audience. As well, we're planning to record some interviews, have some pieces written by some of the speakers today, which will go onto our Australian Outlook blog, now reaches a huge Australian audience, 29,000 unique visitors per month. So that's going to again take it to the wider audience. But I have to say, one of the things I'm really hoping for today is more about what we as individuals take away from here. We are all, I think, myself, are experts in this area and have so much to offer. I think if we form some connections, if we find people in this room who are doing interesting work that we did not know about, if we find about something that is relevant to our work that we weren't aware of, that I think is a fantastic result. So for me, that's the core, and then we'll be taking the discussion wider. Now, you'll see there is one gap here today. Joanne Wallace was going to be with us. Unfortunately, she is, fortunately for her, she's very pregnant, she's expecting, and unfortunately her doctor has said that she is not allowed to go anywhere, she is on bed rest. So we know what priorities are in life, and new life is a big one of those, so we quite understand she can't be here. But I can tell you that she was very involved in the planning process. And I know that she would have been talking about the importance of taking national security discussions into account throughout today. She was very keen that we talk about things like the Pacific Maritime Security Initiative, looking at patrol boats and what do they mean for fisheries, and then what does fisheries mean for food security? What does that mean for rapid urbanisation? What does that mean for the social impact, and what does that mean for the political instability? So seeing that there are so many elements of this discussion that are all interrelated, and it's very hard to separate them. So I give you her apologies. I'm sorry she can't join us today. But the good news for our other speakers is that that means they get 2 whole minutes longer. I decided that. I thought that was nice. We are going to keep our speakers to some sort of time here, and I do apologise ahead of time. There will be a little bell that dings to tell them when it is time to finish. We are very keen to make sure this is a discussion of the experts in the room. So we very much appreciate you getting us started, giving us questions, and then we want to throw it open to everyone in the room to make sure that we hear your voices as well. So without any further ado, I'd like to turn to Phil Hill, who I think is first on the list. He's the project leader for Plant Biosecurity Cooperative Research Centre. And I think you even have some pretty pictures to show us, is that right?
A few words and slides.
Thanks
very much, Melissa. Very happy to be here today. So my name's Bill McGee. I work at the Plant Biosecurity Cooperative Research Centre, but most of my working life has been in the Australian Quarantine and Inspection Service, working on plant biosecurity from the mid-80s until 2014. And before I get underway with the talk, it's very interesting to just, when we're thinking today about this connection between plant biosecurity, or biosecurity generally, food security and regional stability, if I look back on my own work, in Australia, working in plant biosecurity, or as it was known, plant quarantine, our focus through the 80s, 90s, and indeed most of the 2000s, was very much on the protection of Australia for reasons of production, and protection of our market access and protection of our environment. But I can tell you that in my work, we never had a really sharp focus on the food security dimension to this. And I think that's because the introduction of pests and diseases into a country like Australia, there's obvious effects on your production, there's obvious effects on your market access, there's obvious effects on the environment, but we don't really correlate it as strongly in the area of food security. But that all changed about 3 years ago, when I started this work in Africa, which I'll talk a little bit about today, where the impact of plant biosecurity is quite dramatic on food security. Dramatic to the extent in countries that produce maize or bananas, it might be 50% of their production of their staple food. So it's changed my thinking a lot, and I think internationally too, there's a much stronger recognition of this relationship between food security and plant biosecurity. But the really great thing about this is that we'll then connect the third part about the regional stability, which I've never thought about at all, to be honest. So you'll forgive me if I use the term Pacific and Melanesian Arc a little bit interchangeably, because a lot of the experience in the Pacific. There's quite a... I mean, we're fortunate that there's a lot of coverage of this region of the world through a number of agencies, and forgive if I left anybody out here, because I'm just talking about the main ones that I've worked with. But certainly the Department of Agriculture and Water Resources, and we've got Nick Nolan here today, has done excellent work in the Pacific on Fiji, on taros, ginger, and a whole range of other products. The Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade has been a long-standing sponsor and supporter of all the work in the Pacific. The Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research is represented here today by Andrew and Melissa, and maybe some others, and Annie. And certainly they've got a very, very long and successful history of research in this region of the world. And the Plant Biosecurity Cooperative Research Centre, we're fortunate to have here Professor John Lovett, who's done some wonderful work in Indonesia. And also, of course, the Crawford Fund, who are active all around the world, but in this region as well, and wonderful effort to pull this all together. So the capacity building activities generally yield a better understanding of the plant pest risks in the region. They improve regional biosecurity, build diagnostic networks, which is so important for all of these countries to have the diagnostic capability to know what they have and for us to know what they have. And they foster links among the plant biosecurity agencies across the region. So it also has the other benefit of helping Australia meet its own obligations of helping developing countries under the sanitary and phytosanitary agreement. just to run through, these are just some examples of some fairly iconic threats we've got from this region. The Asian citrus psyllid goes in conjunction with citrus greening, which is a bacterial disease of the citrus industry. It's probably the number one threat around the world, and the countries that have it certainly will tell you that we don't want it. The vegetable leaf miner. Vegetable leaf miner causes problems up in the North and Torres Strait, and that's certainly a great concern to our vegetable industry in Australia. Exotic fruit flies. People may remember in the mid-1990s we had the famous papaya fruit fly was found in Cairns, and it cost $33 million, which at the time was a lot of money 20 years ago, to eradicate. But there's other fruit flies that we don't have. Melon fly and New Guinea fruit fly, and the North Australian quarantine strategy does a lot of trapping for these flies in Northern Australia, because the economic impact for us if we get them is quite dramatic with a lot of our market access. The Siam weed, we've had problems with that before, and military equipment coming back from the Pacific area caught up in the radiators of all the army vehicles, and that's a serious weed. There's a whole lot of others. NARC's employ a botanist, a lady called Barbara Waterhouse, very famous botanist. And every time she goes on holidays around the world, on the rare time she takes a holiday, she'll find a new weed in the country she's in, which causes quite a bit of chaos in that country. But they're very grateful for it in the long term. I also mentioned citrus canker because, you know, citrus canker's up in this area. And people may remember we had a very serious incident at Emerald in Queensland, about 15 years ago, 2004. And that didn't come in through this route, unfortunately. It came in through illegal material. But again, there's a massive eradication, highly disruptive to all those industries, disruptive to our international reputation. So these are just a snapshot of some of the things that we're concerned about. So I mentioned NARCS before. This program was set up in 1989. There have been a few precursors to NARCS, but a very, very successful program provides an early warning system. They are fortunate they've done quite a bit of survey work in Irian Jaya, Papua New Guinea, I think parts of Indonesia NARCS has been up to, in the Torres Strait. And they've found a lot of things very either prevented them coming in, or they've found them very early in Northern Australia so that we can eradicate them. These are just a few of the ones I've mentioned, the papaya fruit fly, but also in 96 they found black ciguatera of bananas, of weeper, triggering eradication, grapevine rust in Darwin, and yellow burrweed in Cairns, and there's a whole pile of other things that they've found in their great work they do. I should also mention here the Pacific Horticulture and Market Access Program, which Nick's very involved in here. And that's co-funded by Australia and New Zealand. And you know, DFAT's really, it's a DFAT initiative, and it's been a wonderful initiative. And very much looking at helping those countries with market access. So we did quite a bit of work up there in my old job on taros, and just cleaning up the supply chain. There wasn't a new trade, it was a trade that kept falling over because the taros had come in but they'd be dirty or they'd have mould on them. And the thing we learned about that was it wasn't a policy question or a scientific question, it was about cleaning up the supply chain. And so our work up there in Fiji on that was really flying out to Tabiuni where they grow the taros and following the taros all the way through to Australia to work out what was happening in that supply chain. So some of the work can be as practical as that, but still reaping a lot of benefits to that region. So for pharma, Australia and New Zealand have traditionally been the main markets of interest. And the core countries up there are Fiji, Tonga, Samoa, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands and New Guinea. But they, PhRMA also provides assistance to other Pacific Islands through the Pacific community. So just in the balance, I mean, PhRMA quite openly has a market access orientation to help those countries with market access, and it's got less emphasis on the pest and disease work within that country. But as we think to the future of possibly a replacement for PhRMA, there's some, I'll raise the issue around the balance there of market access versus the effort that might go into helping with actual production systems in those countries for their own food security. The PhRMA's just got a little extension till June 2018, if I've heard. The other thing I wanted to talk about is people be aware that, you know, in Rome we have the International Plant Protection Convention. They have regional bodies. So in looking at this part of the world, the Pacific Plant Protection Organisations are the regional standard-setting body. And it's very much in the region's interests, but also in Australia's interests, for the Pacific Plant Protection Organisation to be a functional and strong group. And there's quite a bit of work to do there. You know, if we think about plant biosecurity in the Pacific, getting this organisation to work well, to develop regional standards that help with food security and plant biosecurity, and representation to the international body in Rome, is a very important thing. So I flag that as an area in looking to the future, re-establishing the effectiveness and the impact of the PPPO. But I want to raise this other thing. So, you know, when you think about multinational investment, I'll use an example from Africa, but it could be any developing country. Recently in Mozambique, or some years back, a very, very large multinational company went to Mozambique, very attractive to the Mozambique government because they had enormous investment, enormous capital, and they set up a massive monoculture in Cavendish bananas. So jobs, food, it's all looking great. But with this sort of multinational investment, where's the interaction with the plant biosecurity risks that might come with that, with workers and with machinery? And one thing we're learning is that in the sort of stampede of multinationals to go into the developing world to shore up their own food supplies or their own profits, what is their line of sight on the plant biosecurity risks? What is the prevalence of the plant biosecurity officials in those countries to be in those discussions? Is it just happening between the trade portfolio and the... So our message in Africa has very much been to our colleagues who work in plant biosecurity, you need to talk to your departments of foreign affairs or your foreign investment groups to make sure you're part of those discussions. Because there's a number of examples. So what happened in Mozambique was they got Panama disease. Now, fortunately, they've contained it for the moment in that massive monoculture, but if the company goes broke and moves away, it'll spread into the small farmholders. So this is just a really key point about we have to have some interaction with multinationals and get the countries to understand that when that investment's happening, you need to be there. Finish up very quickly now. But also balancing the investment. You know, if a lot of this investment's in market access, we also need to look at how well their production systems are for their own food. For some of these countries, the market access is going to be a long road because of the supply chain, but at least if they can have their own food production working well, that's important. The supply chain and also supporting regional growth. And I know that in the next iteration of PhRMA, or the future one, there's a lot of work around how it all affects regional growth. So just to finish off, there's some informal discussions underway at the moment between Department of Agriculture and Water Resources, Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade, ACR, and I've been representing the CRC at those discussions, around for coordinating all of our activities in the region, and this is in the context of the future of PhRMA and future of other capacity building work. But one model that we have talked about is the one in Africa, whereby we bring a lot of biosecurity specialists over to Australia and train them. We work on the pests and diseases of most concern to the region, and then we go back there and train them in the region. I won't go on about that now, but it is a model that we could look at for the Pacific, and Melissa's done a lot of excellent work in sort of discussing that with DFAT about the future. That's all. Thank you.
Fixing the cable, I'll start. Firstly, must stress, I am not an expert on Melanesia. I have been there, and one of my jobs way back in the 1970s was to help establish the sugar industry in New Guinea, but I don't think I've been back since. However, I was for 5 years from 2007 to 2012 Director General of the International Water Management Institute. And we were working on a wide range of problems to do with food security and water insecurity in Southeast Asia, in the Pacific, and through into Africa. And what I'm trying to do today is give some sort of generic overview of some of the issues and try and relate them to what is and could happen in parts, not all, but parts of Melanesia. I'll start with an anecdote. When I started at IMI in 2007, as you do when you're a new Director General, you go around to all the big agencies and introduce yourself. I went to the ADB and was told quite plainly that by the Deputy Managing Director that agriculture and food were a sunset area for them. And I said, but there's a food crisis starting now, which we knew about in 2007-2008, an eyebrow twitched and raised, but the ADB just were not prepared for that kind of issue arising. I think we'll see more frequent food crises as factors come together to create a range of uncertainties. But I finished the anecdote by saying in 2013, after the crisis, but after everyone became much more aware of food security, I was asked to chair a meeting of the Asian Finance Ministers meeting and general meeting in Hong Kong. And I was a bit trepidatious about this, being not an expert in finance or economics or any of those areas. And then they told me that, and then I noticed that the food and water security session was on at the same time as Larry Summers, the ex-advisor for the US President, Harvard professor, was talking about his view of economics. And I said, well, which little room are we in on food and water? And they said, no, you're in the main hall. We had 600 or 700 people attend that. Larry got about 70. So by then, this was a really critical issue, recognized by a very wide suite or range of people involved in food and agriculture, finance and economics throughout the Asia region. And I think it's still a very critical area of importance because, Crawford Fund has been suggesting, there are very strong linkages between what happens when countries become food and water insecure and social unrest, potentially sort of out-migration, and other factors which are going to cause political problems for those countries and political problems, as we've seen in Australia, for neighbouring countries where people try and migrate to legally or illegally. Or perhaps we shouldn't use the word illegally. So, there are a number of examples which you can draw on since the 2007-2008 food crisis where there has been growing evidence of unrest due to food security. Darfur, the Syrian drought, and all the issues around the 2007-2008 food crisis, which followed through with food riots in Egypt, whether or not these were related in the in other countries, including Libya and Tunisia, to the Arab Spring is uncertain, but they certainly drive sort of unrest in a number of countries which are very dependent on food imports. And at the same time, we saw knee-jerk reactions in countries like India, which closed its borders to exports when it had plenty of food and could have helped. Black markets thriving in Pakistan and Afghanistan in terms of cross-border migration of food supplies, which creates biosecurity and all sorts of other problems. So very strong linkages there. So I wanted to stress in this short talk that food security, while it causes those problems, it is linked very much to water security and to climate change. I wanted to touch on some of the risks that might occur in the Melanesian Arc, and hopefully I'll have time just to come through to a number of what I think are very relatively simple solutions. We really ought to start the meeting, however, with a bit of a definition of food security, and I think it's important to recognise there are three pillars to this. I'm not going to read all that to you, but food availability, food access, and food utilisation, how people cook it, prepare it, make it safe for eating, and so on. So it's not just about availability of a total amount of food. It is about that. It is about access. Can it be got for people in the right time, in the right place? And it's about how it's prepared and how nutritious it is. If we look at drivers of food security, these are fairly common across the whole of the globe. They are clearly increasing demand for food, and increasing demand in particular for more protein-rich Western diet-style food, which is pushing the demand for products like high-protein products like milk, like meat, like chicken. And often, as we know, these take more land, more resources to produce than cereals and vegetables. So the overall driver there is population growth, which is very, very important. 70% of the world is already physically scarce of water, and a lot of the remainder, particularly the developing world, has not had the infrastructure put in place to make sure there is access to water. That can be described as economic water scarcity. So water scarcity is a big, big problem. And when we start thinking about climate change impacts, that's going to become another very, very critical, or it is already a very critical issue in terms of growing enough food and growing enough nutritious food. Urbanisation, where agricultural land is taken over and water resources are taken over for burgeoning cities. Changing land use. One of the major contributors to the 2007-08 food crisis was China starting to produce more and more biofuel from some of its maize and corn crops and going into the export market in a big way, pushing up prices. So it wasn't really a scarcity issue. There wasn't enough food. It was a price-related issue as well, which combined with drought and a number of other market factors. And obviously climate change, which I'll come to briefly in a moment. As we look at the Pacific and the Melanesian Arc, and I guess we could also, from the purposes of the view from Australia, consider parts of Indonesia, Timor-Leste, which has some similar issues to parts of Papua New Guinea. When we look at the figures there, about 2.7 million people in the Pacific don't have the income or subsistence production to meet their basic human needs. So we already have knowledge about the issue in the region. That's compounded by the fact that PNG, Solomons and Kiribati are amongst the poorest countries in the world. And there are sort of specific issues, particularly in Fiji, with urbanisation and problems with squatter settlements there and in PNG in terms of getting food, well, poor people and getting food to them. There are a number of conflating factors, which relate to food and water, security and insecurity. This issue of lack of access to adequate sanitation and clean drinking water is a problem in parts of the area. Another issue in our northern neighbour is the remoteness of part of the country with limited road access, and there we already have ongoing local conflicts. We have high HIV/AIDS problems in some of the areas, which mean that the population may be not as productive as we would hope it could be because of health issues. Again, this lack of access to clean water and sanitation. And these are compounded by rampant destruction of natural resources due to poor governance often, habitat destruction, increasing pollution of land from land-based sources, which are affecting fisheries, particularly near shore fisheries, and just over-harvesting of total resources. Just to give an idea of population in the region, this is reasonably current, and their predictions, but we're looking at population growth going up to about 16 million in Melanesia. Very, very small migration numbers in and out. In fact, as I think John Anderson mentioned, a lot of people love living in these areas and are not want to move away from them whenever possible. But in some cases in Fiji, quite a significant urban population. Climate change is going to be a key issue for us. As I was waking up this morning, I'm going to Lincoln, Nebraska in a few weeks to give a talk about Australian water reform and markets there. And my wife is coming with me, said, well, what's the weather going to be in Lincoln, Nebraska? So I had a look at today's temperature. It was 23 degrees centigrade in Lincoln, Nebraska, which is a Midwest state normally covered in snow at this time of year. That is completely atypical. It said record highs. So, you know, hopefully signals like that may be getting through to some of the American politicians about the fact that climate change is going to be critical. In terms of, I heard the bell, thank you. In terms of specific risks, crop and fowl mortality due to excessive heat, particularly in parts of low-lying islands in the Pacific and Melanesia, seawater intrusion. Drought, particularly severe in El Nino events. I think it has already been a feature in parts of Papua New Guinea. Increasing storm intensity, and Bill has already touched on some of these issues of changing pest and disease vectors and factors. I just wanted to stress there that most of the Melanesian arc is in this seasonal wet and dry climate where they have a marked wet season but often have significant moderate rains through the dry season. But these kind of environments are prone to drought and they are very prone to the impacts of climate change. In terms of food security, I've got three slides to cover now. In the region, long-term food security has remained stable compared with overall long-term growth of 1 to 2% in Australia and the US as comparators. There have been impacts of changes in dietary sources which are contributing to obesity and related diseases. There has been a growing reliance, as we've seen many other countries in the world, on commercial markets and greater susceptibility to global price ranges affecting particularly the poor, as I think was mentioned by John earlier on. There are technological constraints, lack of know-how to ag production. There's been declining investment in ag R&D and generally not always a lack of private sector involvement. But if we look at solutions and think, well, what could these be? And I guess this is something which we can throw open and discuss in more detail later. We can start from the premise that in Melanesia, the existing ag systems in the region did provide nutritious and enough food. They were often farming and I can't think of the right term, but slash and burn type of agriculture where people moved on from one site to another and then let the previous site recover over a number of years. Those kind of systems provide insurance against world market factors and lack of buying power amongst populations. I'm not advocating that we can go back to them because of population pressure, but there are some lessons we may learn from them in terms of encouraging local food production. We may have to come up with different solutions to combat sea level rise and storm intensity, which will rely on food imports and development of local food banks and so on to tide people through in extreme events. But we can also start to think about how infrastructure improvement may improve market access and food distribution in some of the countries in the region. And there are, related to my last slide, a number of ways that communities can insure against drought, which will probably be one of the biggest issues for some of these communities, through known technical interventions. And none of this is rocket science. They are simple issues like access to water and water storage to provide supplementary irrigation. In terms of some of the urban areas and market potential market gardening, they can be related to water recycling rather than just tipping it all into the ocean. And water recycling schemes don't have to be state-of-the-art, really high science-based solutions. I think if we look around the world as a whole, 700 million people in 2007-08 were reliant on vegetables grown in almost untreated effluent. I'm not suggesting we go to that extreme, but with simple treatment, you can clean up effluent and you can put in place practices which make it a very useful source of both water and nutrients for market gardens. We can look across the spectrum of improved agricultural water management systems, which include supplementary irrigation, but include a range of other techniques. We still need to continue looking at agronomic R&D, including varietal improvement, specific to some of the regions we're investing in. Pest and disease resistance is going to be vitally important, and also improved plant nutrition. Often in these areas, yields are very, very low compared with potential biological yields. So there are big yield gaps, and we can push yield up by simple interventions using known technology. We can look more at agroforestry systems, and we can look at more protection for both terrestrial and estuarine habitats to protect particularly the fish resource, which is so important in parts of the Pacific. It's still the largest source of protein intake in many Pacific countries. So the end of my message is there are some critical issues that are going to confront many countries around the world and the developing world, and I don't think many countries in the Pacific and Melanesia will be immune. But the real take-home message to me is that with limited focused investment, such as Australia has already been doing through ACR, with more of that, we can start to take some of these simple solutions, put in place pilots, get them adopted, and give people a lot of insurance and protection against what may be the ravages of climate change and drought and some of these other factors. Thank you.
So what I'd like to do now is to turn very much to discussion in the room. This is not question and answer, this is discussion. I will come back to our speakers right at the end of the discussion if they have any concluding thoughts they would like to share with us. But what we're interested in is your perspective. So you've heard two perspectives here now. I'm interested in your reactions. What things did that confirm that you know? What things were new for you? What impact does that have on the work you do? So what I'll do is I'll ask you to quickly identify yourself. I know most of you, but not everybody in this room. So I'll just go around the room and see who's interested in starting off. Okay, so that's the back is.
Thank you, may I just take a minute to compliment what Bill said about
and
being
and please here. Introduce yourself.
John Lovett, Foundation Chair of the CRC. John Anderson actually gave a very good opportunity to think about Indonesia, and the CRC recognised back in 2004 that we couldn't have a credible regional programme without engaging with that country. Our initial activity was mainly around capacity building, and that was successful to the extent that we now have a number of our former trainees who are in quite influential positions in Indonesia, including a senior advisor in President Jokowi's office. The Jokowi agenda, which we'll probably talk about later, for agriculture is very strong. Like Australia, the Indonesians are concentrating on trade and market access, and they're also promoting what they call food sovereignty, which is a rather different spin on the term that we're more familiar with, but food sovereignty is the goal as far as President Jokowi is concerned. In addition to common interests that we have with Indonesia in agriculture and trade, we are both mega biodiverse countries. And so we have another interest in protecting our biodiversity, which of course can be threatened by the sorts of invasions that Bill spoke about earlier. So to build on what had gone before and to address this largely common agenda, we began in 2015 to put in place a bilateral plant biosecurity initiative. We signed up on that last April. It's operating from four centres, from Kupang in West Timor, which is about as close to Melanesia as we get, Denpasar, Bali, Salatiga, West Java, and Manado in northern Sulawesi. Each of those centres is responsible for one aspect of a biosecurity programme, from surveillance and early warning all the way through to policy development. We have put in place already a technology called remote microscopy, which is a fantastic tool to use in an archipelago of 200 islands, and indeed will be a fantastic tool to use in Melanesia too. It enables plant biosecurity operatives to be linked to each other, but also to be linked to the rest of the world in real time. And if you're in the business of trying to identify pests and diseases, it's a fantastic technological development. That's enough detail. I wanted to just draw to your attention a thought leadership paper that we published earlier this month. It's called Opportunities and Benefits for Collaboration on Indonesian Plant Biosecurity. This is probably the only hard copy in captivity. It is available to you on our website, and I'm more than happy to give you the web address. Thanks, Melissa.
Mike Burke's my name. I'm an agriculturalist, been working in PNG for the best part of half a century. A couple of comments, and thanks for that last paper. A couple of comments on food security, quickly, and population. First on population. The last census was a shambles, but I spent 15-16, most of that 12-15 months working in PNG during the drought, working with church partnership, etc. Where we work with good folk on the ground in the provinces, Western Province, Milne Bay, etc., and they've done good census, you can get some pretty good data. The population is well over 8 million now. I saw a projection, I think, for 2030 was 8 million. It's well over 8. The national statistician says we don't really know. It's somewhere between 8 and 10 now being 2016. It's growing, probably about 2.7% per annum. The last census said 3.1. There's not much urbanisation happening, unlike Vila, Santo, Honiara, which are growing at about 4 or 5% per annum. And Moresby is not actually, despite what everyone says, it's getting bigger. Yes, it's getting bigger, but at 3% per annum, the whole country's getting bigger. So the urbanisation of PNG just sounds like hugging. In terms of another point I'd make about the Pacific, or the Melanesian arc, most people, with a major exception in New Guinea, live on the coast. There's some exceptions, Malekula, Malaita, New Britain, New Ireland, Bougainville, but most people live on the coast. So that gives them great food security in the sense they've got access to the two limiting proteins for humans there, which are oils and fats, concentrated forms of energy and protein. They get that from the ocean. The people on the island of New Guinea and East and West New Guinea don't have that. And that's where the most vulnerable people are in the Melanesian arc, aside from the atolls. I've just come off 40 days for my sins working for UNDP. I just finished last Friday, a 75,000 word report, working with some Papua New Guinean Australian colleagues. And one of the exercises I did, I split up Papua New Guinea into 10 what I call ecological zones. There's three of them that are particularly vulnerable, the atolls, which we've just heard about, and that's self-evident why the atolls are vulnerable to climate change and food insecurity. Small islands as well, and there's over 100,000 people in Papua New Guinea, more than the population of Kiribati, live in those two little zones. The really big one is the Central Highlands. That's where 42% of the population live. I won't go into the reasons for that, but it's really, really big. It's huge. And then the other one is a very high altitude, above 2,000 metres. I won't say any more. I'll say one last thing. If you look at where people are vulnerable, the 97 drought, which is the biggest one in the last 130 years, the one with 1914, or the 15-16 drought, which is slightly smaller, if you look at that, they fall into similar zones. The high altitude, above 2,200, between 2,200 and 2,800 metres. The second zone is lots and lots of places on the edge of the highlands or in the mountains, places that most people, even in PNG, haven't heard of and haven't been there. They're really obscure, they're really remote. Thirdly, it's inland, lowland, western province, partly where Indonesia, Queensland and Papua New Guinea meet, the Morehead region, but particularly where the highest death rate was in 1516, was actually in the Nomad LLG. The next zone is small islands, particularly Milne Bay, where there's 30 small islands, 16 atolls and 14 other small islands, and another small island. So that overlaps with climate change, but not perfectly. So the events of 1516, 97, 98, 72, 73, going back 41, 42, 14, 15, 03, 04, etc. These are similar to what we're starting to see with climate change now, but they're not the same places. And I'll just say one last thing. My colleagues, Matt Canower, myself, and Brendan Jinks did a little booklet, if anyone wants it. It's about food security in PNG, how to assess it, a field guide, but it does draw on our experience in 1516. If anyone wants a copy, I'll leave it at that, thanks.
Yeah, well, we're already getting a reading list for everybody in the room, which I like. Maybe if people want to put out the publications they're advertising on the table during morning tea, people can come and see it and find it online later. Thank you. Okay. Who else wants to?
Interested in the cultural propensities to migrate. John Anderson touched on this slightly. He mentioned the example of Indonesia, where I think he said, that, and Bill Blood said this the other day, they're not naturally a migrating people. Even the Transmigrasi program that tried to ship people from Java to the eastern part of the country has been reversed as people actually go back to Java. Clearly this has, if you draw the parallel with Syria, where drought led to massive urbanisation, which created the cesspool for exploitation by all sorts of extremists. And I think John Anderson also said we can't necessarily apply the lessons of Syria to the Melanesian art. But are there people in the room that know about the cultural propensity to migrate?
I might ask people to respond on that. So
there must be people here that know about this.
Hi, Ashton Robinson, University of Melbourne. I just make the comment that during the very great troubles following the fall of Suharto in Indonesia, particularly when we had some quite serious pogroms in eastern Indonesia, the Ambon area in particular, I think I'm right in recalling that we had about in excess of 300,000 people displaced in some of those small island communities, and without exception, that displacement occurred inside Indonesia itself. We had, despite it being a comparatively somewhat maritime culture, we had no movement of people as genuine refugees by boats out of that either to Australia or to points further east in the archipelago. So I think that certainly with the whole issue that we've had on boat arrivals surrounding Operation Sovereign Borders over recent years, I think again I'm right in saying not a single passenger on any of those boats has actually been of Indonesia itself. So I think that there's some quite profound empirical indications that we're not looking at a migratory culture, particularly in eastern Indonesia, even under circumstances of quite extreme stress and evident opportunity.
Thank you. And are you agreeing with Dennis that that might be partly a cultural thing?
Absolutely, yeah.
Yes, Minister. Ruth Pierce, I was the Big Fella Mary boss for Long Australia in Solomon Islands back in the 90s. But there was an assumption that Melanesians don't move, migrate. And there was a contrast with Polynesians. Polynesians get in their boats and row and move around. But Melanesia, because basically their resources, they were rich, essentially, and didn't have to even move within their own country. And there was a lot of sort of Wontok focus as well. So, you know, and it's expressed in their religion, spiritual. Polynesia is sort of big and universal, and Melanesia is sort of much more spiritual. So, and we found that in our Australian, there was no little interest in my even short-term work within certainly Solomon Islands, Melanesia generally, Papua New Guinea, compared with Polynesia, New Zealand, etc. So I think there is a quite striking cultural difference. But whether it's, you know, as strong as it was back then, that would be an interesting issue.
And what stresses might change.
Bruce Hunt from the ANU. Just to add to Ruth's comment, I can't answer the question, but it'd be interesting for someone to look at the number of applications or applicants within Polynesia migrating to New Zealand. Perhaps we're not the best magnet to look at here, but rather we should look at New Zealand. And my understanding from when I was in Tonga, particularly the Samoans and the Tongans, in good numbers would apply for the annual migration ticket to New Zealand. I've forgotten the details, New Zealand gives a number of migration passes to Polynesians every year to come and migrate, and the numbers applying out of Polynesia to go to New Zealand is way beyond the figure finally allocated. So I think Ruth is right in that the migration sense is more within Polynesia, perhaps to New Zealand, rather than to Australia.
And so just in that context, Auckland is meant to be the largest Polynesian city in the world.
Yeah.
We went there for the World Cup and the Samoan flags outnumbered the All Black flags.
In addition, there are all sorts of social problems within Auckland and New Zealand about the mix between Polynesians and New Zealanders. So, yeah, it's a significant problem in New Zealand.
Brian Dunham, ANU. If you look at the 2000 Papua New Guinea census of where people were born, heads of households were born and where they now reside, there's a very, very clear pattern of people moving from poorest provinces to wealthiest provinces. Mm.
Tim Reeves, I chair the Agriculture Forum in the Academy, and I'm on the board of the Crawford Fund. I just want to pick up and reinforce a couple of the points, but particularly that you said, Colin, and that is to consider whether the trends that we're talking about and that have been going on for years, and we've known some of these issues, are going to be changed dramatically by climate change. I think that it could be so disruptive that some of the trends we've been looking at in some areas could be reversed and could be greatly accelerated in others. About a year ago, the Director General of the Food and Agriculture Organization of the United Nations, FAO, said that climate change is no longer a future threat to agriculture and food production. Well, you know, what a sentence that was. He said, because it's actually happening right now. And he said, when we look at an inventory of the United Nations countries, the members of FAO, that rising sea levels, particularly in relation to inundation, either over the top of lowland rice
producing areas, or underneath in terms of salinization of groundwater, is already significant in a number of areas. A cold shock in Vietnam killed a lot of cattle. A cold shock in Vietnam. These sort of things, they're unheard of before. You're 23 degrees in Lincoln, Nebraska, etc. So I think that is a question that we need to look at. Will we see an increased urgency around food security, around migration, around insecurity, because of the, not so much in a sense the longer term warming, etc., but the already elevated CO2, the already greater climate variability, the already greater extremes of climate that we've been looking at for a number of years. So I think that, to me, is a policy question.
Puts more strain on all of those securities.
Yes, David from Vanuatu section in DFAT. Thank you both for two very thought-provoking presentations. And with the case of Vanuatu, I mean, issues that I've considered explicitly in the wake, for example, of Tropical Cyclone Pam, for food security issues and the recovery there, which were impacted also by El Nino drought effects as well. The most, I think, disturbing thing for me, purely because I haven't actually explicitly considered the question before, is the issue of biosecurity and the importation of equipment and plant works and those things for these multilateral infrastructure projects that are going on there. And I'm sure that there's good work being done, but there's certainly some inquiries that I will make of our post in Port Vila and some of our managing contractors as to how we're managing those things. I know that there's work that is being done by ASEA and FAMO for market access and developing drought-resistant species for you know, subsistence farming, but this whole issue of biosecurity is certainly a question that I find a little bit disturbing, and whether we're managing that appropriately in Vanuatu. I just have to talk to other people during the day, the course of the day, about some of these issues too.
Charlie Dorfus, also from DFAT. A couple of comments, I guess. One, just on the general topic of the relationship between food security and other forms of security. We could, of course, add a fourth dimension, which is health security. A couple of dimensions of that. One is the sort of zoonotic disease elements, avian influenza and so on, which are clearly very close links there between food and health issues. And then as the other one of the other speakers mentioned, the links between food and nutrition and the sort of triple burden of over nutrition and micronutrient deficiency. So that's just a sort of a fourth dimension, if you wanted to put a four instead of a three on the whole topic. Secondly, just on the issue of climate change, obviously it's complicated. We'll be talking more about fisheries this afternoon, but, you know, one of the findings of some research, I think, that ANU carried out a few years back was that basically the fish stocks are going to be moving eastwards across the Pacific. And so the implications of that for the economies and the national security of, you know, the sort of, all those security issues around the Pacific in terms of access to fisheries and so on could be quite significant. So, you know, it's not just that climate change is going to make people have less food or, you know, that there are risks, but the whole sort of relativities of access to resources and so on could change quite significantly. So,
yes, Tim Reeves again. Can I just follow up on that? Jolted my mind about this whole question around nexus issues and how we're dealing with them. And I'm sure in this meeting here, it's around trying to actually look at the nexus. And one can look at, you know, agriculture, food and nutritional security, and human health. And we don't do that particularly well. You know, we are pretty silent there. But then one can add to it, and the Europeans have been doing this with their Horizon 2020 program in the last few years, of looking at between agriculture, food and nutritional security, low carbon energy options, water management, and climate change. And, you know, I mean, just being simplistic there, one could look at a low carbon energy option, which it could be biofuels, but it could be hydro. And of course, the hydro, yes, it solves, you know, part of your energy problem, but causes tremendous disruption in relation to the waterways, food production systems associated with them, etc., etc. So again, in terms of policy, how in Australia are we dealing with these complex nexus issues rather than just taking them up in sections?
Any of our policy people want to respond?
Not a policy person, but just wanted to add to the conversation about nutrition.
I think Colin,
Melissa Wood from ACR. Colin, I think you commented it's complex. I think one of the things we're recognising now is one of the drivers behind poorer nutrition is economic development. And as countries become more prosperous and families become more prosperous, they change their diet and they tend to prefer less nutritious, more processed foods, and that's particularly current and relevant in the Pacific. And when you look at what most of us are here for, which is to help developing countries become more prosperous, it's something to keep in the back of your mind that how we can help these communities and countries become more economically prosperous, but also retain dietary diversity and good diet.
Under the definition of food security.
I've
only got time for a couple more before I go back.
Also, before we talk about the policy, something I haven't heard mentioned here today, following up on Tim Reeves' comment, the comments made by Professor Will Steffen about the likely 1.5 degree, at least 1.5 degree lock-in temperature rise we have with carbon emissions already in the atmosphere, and the potential implications around, for one example, being ocean acidification and its interference with the very base of the food chain, so whether it's shellfish or fish larvae. And if we get to critical tipping point thresholds, it's not, it'd be a non-linear response where there's a potential widespread rapid collapse of the base of the food chain, and that was built on top of it, and the food security and social security issues around that, and tying in with the confluence nexus issues. That's only one biophysical tipping point, and there are many other tipping points that are difficult to map in an interrelated complex system.
I'm irrigation general, Fiji, and High Commissioner. But the one thing I've taken from the presentation today is that there's definitely a need for collaboration between Australia and its neighbours. We talked about Indonesia, talked about the Pacific, be it Melanesia or whatever it is. But the fact remains that most of the research is done here in Australia for the biosecurity purposes, for your export purposes. And a lot of the money is actually spent by you in research and. And sometimes it gets difficult for you to pass on the information to the smaller nation that are dependent on aid and assistance. I think, yes, you have an organization that shares some of this information, but if you imagine the police force or the military, they have a much better network of sharing information, intelligence. Yet we as, the scientists and the custodians of the food security, which actually ends up with the national security, need to have this network. You pointed out that everything boils down to water. And I think if you focus on water, the food and the rest of it, nutrition, all of that will fall in place. But it remains for us to see how we can actually decipher some of the information you gather here and how relevant it is for us. I mean, in my presentation, I have an issue about termites that Fiji is facing. And I know that your Queensland area has got a proper system in place to control and monitor all that. We're not sharing this information. So, just, you know, I think it's a very, very obvious observation.
Nat Burke from WWF Australia. Really great discussion so far, and one of the things I really hope we can get into through the day is some of the sort of broader social and cultural elements around food security. A big priority for us is around gender-inclusive approaches to agriculture and fisheries. So when we look at stuff coming out of the FFA and the SPC, really prioritising the empowerment and involvement of women in sustainable fisheries management. Or we look at FAO have estimated that if women were given the same access to resources and training and even equipment as men in smallholder situations, the productivity of smallholder farms could more than double. So I think there's just that sort of broader kind of social inclusion element that we really need to bring to this discussion.
Mike Burke again. I want to make a broader point. Food security now is so much better than it was before I was born in 1940. So much better. In Melanesia, it is much better. But the reasons are, first of all, new species. The first comment we have had comes from a bloke called Malinowski, writing 100 years ago, 1915. He says, on the island of Kirrawina, a trading group, the introduction of sweet potato that got rid of the big hunger. It's a big mala, I think is the term. And it starts with sweet potato, crops in America, xanthosoma, new world taro, cultivars coming out of Asia. Cultivars to some degree, but particularly species. So food security is much, much better than it was, certainly 130 years ago, but even up to 1940. It's also better for another reason, that's to do with money, filthy money. People, by the way, are out of trouble. A little anecdote. Back in 97, I was being very critical of what Australia was doing in Papua New Guinea. One of my colleagues is wiser than me, said, but he'd been very critical of Australia. Not perfect, but compare where I work in West New Guinea, where a lot more people died in the 97 drought than in Papua New Guinea. Why? Because of lack of economic integration and lack of money. People, by the way, are the trouble. In 15-16, yes, people died in the Central Highlands, but not in massive numbers. They had money. Where the death rate went up, where people suffered terribly, where people sold their daughters into prostitution, etc. The common denominator is not the crop they ate, the colour of their skin, the language. The common denominator is poverty and remoteness. Development matters. So it is much better. I just want to switch to something else about threats. We talked about climate change. I was in Lima, Peru, a couple of years ago. My wife and I had a bit of a holiday, and I gave a talk at Centro International de la Papa, and I was talking about climate change in Papua New Guinea and said it had gone up 1 degree centigrade between 79 and 09 over a 30-year period, which is much faster than has happened. That's the same rate of increase between about 1750 and about 1990 or 2000, 1 degree C. In the island of New Guinea, it's gone up in 30 years, and the comment from the folk in Lima was that's the same rate over the same period as 1.0 degrees. So in the tropical highlands, for a number of reasons which I won't go into, but the experts explained to me, in the highlands of the tropics, the air is cleaner, etc., climate change is happening faster than it is in the lowlands of the Pacific and happening globally. Not as fast as the Arctic, but certainly faster than much of our region. I'll leave it at that.
Yeah, that's right.
Well, I'd like to finish up just by going back to our speakers. There are a lot of comments. You started a lot of discussion. Would you like to?
Perhaps one thing I didn't mention was there's quite a lot of very well-intentioned foreign aid going into the Pacific from other countries aimed at improving agricultural production systems, but some of that foreign aid hasn't addressed the plant biosecurity considerations, so they've actually introduced some pest diseases into horticulture and into animal industries as well. So that's just another area that perhaps we should think about. And a lot of this is about just the visibility of biosecurity in any of these well-intentioned projects, whether it's infrastructure or foreign aid for new industries, that they think about that, that they're not introducing the problem the same.
And is that just lack of knowledge, lack of training?
Yeah, it's probably both on the behalf of the provider of the foreign aid, but also the recipient country. And you can understand they're keen to get a new industry started, they're keen to get new planting material in, But thinking about the health of that material is very important. That's just another point I didn't have.
Well, I guess I learned a lot from hearing that the discussion and conversations. And I suppose what it said to me is that one size doesn't fit all. We clearly heard comments about there will be hotspots like parts of the PNG Highlands. And I think we need to be thinking about sustainable solutions for those areas in the context of the nexus with health, energy, climate, food and water. And I think the only other point I would stress is that the kind of sustainable solutions we need to be sort of investing in are going to be based on multidisciplinary knowledge. They're not just going in putting one new breed in there, a new variety in. They really are looking at what is the appropriate agricultural knowledge that can be gleaned from work in Australia, New Zealand, other tropical, other countries in the surrounding tropical areas. Can we put these into the context of the natural resource base in the area in terms of water, land, soils, etc.? And then I think this point about infrastructure is critical and prosperity. Can we sort of do these in the context of improved value chains and improved access to market, which can bring in the money which is needed to help people tide themselves through those kind of droughts. So I guess those are my comments. I was particularly interested in in the comment about how we don't do things as well in agriculture as the police or security services would do. There is an organisation called APARI, the Asia Pacific Association of Agricultural Research Institutes. It's a little bit of a bit of a toothless tiger. However, it is a way that we can help improve knowledge networks, and that's probably one way we ought to be thinking about how we can build strength and cooperation through that process. The other thing we do in the Crawford Fund is we do a lot of training and mentoring around the region, and we are, as well as ACR doing this, we are building up a large network of individuals with skills in a lot of these areas. And I think we should be doing more to use those communication channels which already exist to help get information flowing both ways, not just out from the universities and the learned people in the research institutes, but back about what the issues and problems are confronting farmers in the region. So there's some vestigial networks we could build on, but they probably need investment and support to make them more vibrant.
Well, and I think that's a lovely way to finish, is on the network and how do we talk to each other. So we have half an hour now for morning tea. For the people who are talking about their publications, do put those out so people can see those. And for everyone else, please talk to each other. We'll see you back in half an hour.